Hi, this is Joe Castellano. Welcome to the Inside China Basin Baseball Podcast on thesportsvirus.com and now on canbr.com, featuring players like all-star catcher Buster Posey.
It's about, you know, just going out and trying to have passion for the game that I've loved since I was a kid.
And San Francisco Chronicle columnist John Shea is our regular guest, too.
Bumgarner, he's a god, isn't he? He does all these things that no other humans do.
Inside China Basin is brought to you by TPC Harding Park, the only public golf course in San Francisco offering golfers the opportunity to play where the pros play. Coming up, we'll hear from an orange and black left-hander who is vying for a spot in the Giants rotation, and Barry Bloom from MLB.com. But first, let's hear from our sponsors. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. I guess they should have hired me for that TV commercial. No, I don't think so. But seriously, in San Francisco, it's really true. In fact, AT&T Park has a good neighbor right around the corner. That's right, Sandy Lee State Farm is a Buster Posey home run away from AT&T Park at 188 South Park Street on the corner of 3rd Street. Sandy Lee has been my State Farm agent for 10 years, and I have to tell you, when I've made claims, Sandy Lee gave me peace of mind, which is what we all need when it comes to insurance. Whether it's car, home, or even earthquake insurance, Sandy Lee and her team are down-to-earth, devoted, and understanding. They take control of any situation, and you never feel like you're being sold something. Give Sandy Lee State Farm a call at 415-227-9833. That's 415-227-9833 for Sandy Lee State Farm. The next time you're on your way to a Giants game, stop by Town's End Restaurant and Bakery for breakfast and lunch Tuesday through Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 2 p.m., or for brunch on the weekend from 8 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Celebrating their 26th year, family-run and cozy, Town's End Restaurant and Bakery captures the spirit of San Francisco with homemade sourdough English muffins, scones, and breads. They're serving cage-free Petaluma eggs and have been organic since well before organic became mainstream. Consistent quality, 4-star Google reviews, and great service from loyal employees that have been there for over 20 years. Town's End Restaurant and Bakery, a Buster Posey home run away from AT&T Park, right along the Embarcadero at 2 Townsend Street in San Francisco. Our regular guest this season is Giants reliever George Contos. Here's what he has to say about our favorite golf course in San Francisco, TPC Harding Park.
It's a great golf course. It's very convenient for us to get there, and it's a very challenging course. If you're not in your game, you get in the rough. Rough's along there. It's a very beautiful course. They're very gracious and get us out there anytime we're able to get out there for an off day and play some golf. So, with how beautiful the course is and how challenging it can be, it's always a lot of fun getting out there and playing around.
Oh, by the way, if you're in Scottsdale for spring training, you must make time to play the TPC Scottsdale golf courses. I played the Champions course, and it was just spectacular. Back in October, Ty Block helped the Giants get into the playoffs, shutting out the Los Angeles Dodgers and Clayton Kershaw. Now he's vying for the number 5 spot in the Giants rotation, competing with Matt Cain. Just before spring training at Giants Media Day, I had a chance to sit down with Ty Block. Ty, such a great year last year, whether it be the minor leagues or even when you joined the Giants and you came through big for them. So as you reflect on it, what were your thoughts this offseason?
You know, I think it was great to be able to come up and be a part of that playoff run that we had. Obviously, we were a little disappointed the way the season ended, but I think we're looking forward to coming back this year and trying to get all the way to the top.
What does it give you as far as that experience? What do you take with you, especially because you weren't pitching in meaningless games? These were really important games that you pitched in.
Yeah, I think that was a lot of fun. It's what you kind of dream of as a kid, being able to go out there and pitch at the highest level and in the most pressure-packed game. So it was a lot of fun to be able to do that, and just looking forward to what's going to happen this spring.
How did the preparation in the minor leagues really help you? Because, you spend enough time there, you learn a lot. So what are a couple of things that really helped you when you took the major league mound?
I think the biggest thing was just knowing to stay within yourself and can't try to do too much. Just got to go out there and just execute your game plan and execute pitches and trust that defense behind you. And we've sure got a great defense here. So it's pretty awesome to be able to know that they're going to make all the plays for you.
Yeah, the thing that I've always noticed about you is that you were able to hit spots and not walk batters. I mean, it seems like if you do walk somebody, you're really annoyed about it. Is that something that you've kind of carried throughout the minor leagues and now into the majors?
Yeah, I think free bases sometimes can come and bite you in the butt. So you want to be able to limit those as much as you can. And so being able to go out there and execute pitches, I think that's the biggest thing for me. And just like I said, trusting that defense, you know, at least give them a shot to make a play.
What do you focus on when you go into spring training in this situation because you have a real shot at making the rotation? It's going to be a competition.
Just go out there and just kind of get better every day. Not going to do anything different. I'm just going to go out there and compete and just enjoy the moment, enjoy the process, and what's going to happen is going to happen.
It's always interesting, too, in spring training, though. You have some veteran guys that are just kind of getting ready for the season. But when you're competing for a job, how different is that as opposed to just, you know, being in spring training and you're just getting ready?
Yeah, I think for those guys, it's a little different because it is their ability to they have the ability to go out there and get ready. But for some of us young guys, it's our opportunity to show that we can compete at that level. So I'm excited to see what happens and just go out there and compete this spring.
What did you learn from, you know, Buster Posey and the staff and all these guys who have been around and have experienced a lot of success?
You know, they've been tremendous. The coaching staff, Buster, any of the guys in the locker room, just being able to relate to them and just listen to their advice on how to go out there every day and prepare yourself best to execute pitches and get guys out. So they've been awesome just to be able to pick their brains and really looking forward to being around them again.
I was talking to Mark Gardner about this, is that, you know, you have guys that are on the staff that have pitched at the major league level. They know what you're going through, the ups and the downs. Does that factor into it a lot, too?
Yeah, it definitely does. Those guys have been through the battles. They've been through the grind of the season and the ups and downs. They know how it's going to play out. So just the ability to kind of keep a level head and just keep going out there and trying to get better every day, that's the goal. So just enjoying the moment and trying to get better.
Yeah, Mark Gardner was saying a lot of times the main time that he's going to hear from a young pitcher is when things aren't going well. Because if it's going well, I mean, you don't really have to talk too much. But the trust factor, how important is that with everybody, whether it be a pitching coach or the catcher? Because, you know, you've been doing something your whole life a certain way, and you're trying to make adjustments too.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing is, like you said, just the trust and know that those guys are there to help you. And you can lean on them when you need to, and they're going to kind of stay away when you're going right. So it's good to have that and just kind of keep the focus in on where it needs to be and just keep trying to get better.
Did you pick the brain of the other guys in the rotation too, kind of just get a feel for how they go about their business? You know, Bumgarner, Samardzija, Matt Moore, all those guys?
Yeah, those guys have been really great. You know, last year being in the bullpen a little bit, I'd never done that before. So Kaner and Peavy were really awesome about helping me through that. And then moving to the rotation, Bum and Cueto and Samardzija and Matty Moore, they were all awesome. And just being able to give me any advice and know what I needed to do every day to kind of be ready and take that next step.
What did you learn about the pen? I mean, you know, just for the future, in case you end up doing, you know, a dual role or something like that, what did you learn that could make you successful out of the bullpen?
I think the biggest thing that I learned is it's the same game. You just got to go out and execute pitches. And, yeah, the preparation may be a little bit different, but you just got to go out there. And once you're in that game, it's the same thing. So just going out and competing and giving everything you've got.
Before I let you go, what kind of camaraderie is there on this team, guys who have come up through the minor leagues together? I would think that's pretty important. You develop these friendships, and then you see each other. You know, maybe for the offseason you don't for a while, but then you're back together.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty special group of guys. You know, we've got a lot of us that have come up together, and we've been kind of pushing each other all the way up. So it's really fun to have that group of guys, knowing that everybody's pulling for each other and everybody wants each other to do really well. So it's pretty neat.
All right, Ty. Hey, thanks a lot. Congrats on last year, and good luck this season.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's Giants left-hander Ty Block. Coming up, we'll hear from Barry Bloom from MLB.com right after this. A new art book about the lives of minor league baseball players is coming out soon called Fantasy Life, and the author, Tabitha Soren, will be joining us during the season to talk about the book. In the meantime, check out her lecture on Sunday, March the 19th at 4:30 p.m. in Scottsdale. So if you happen to be going to the Giants games in spring training, right near Scottsdale Stadium, there's a Civic Center Auditorium, and that's where Tabitha Soren will be giving her lecture Sunday, March the 19th, 4:30, as she discusses stories on her 15-year project on America's favorite pastime.
Barry, great to catch up with you here in Scottsdale at the Giants camp. And, you know, coming into spring training, the thinking for the Giants was, okay, we've got our closer in Mark Melancon, their big offseason pickup. But they're looking at left field. What are they going to do there? Jarrett Parker, Mack Williamson. And then the number five spot in the rotation is really up in the air because Matt Cain hasn't been the same Matt Cain now for a number of years. So they're looking at him, but others as well. So, you know, what do you think? When you look at the Giants camp, what are some of the areas that you're pinpointing that you're keeping your eyes on?
Well, it's kind of funny. Let me put it into context here where, you know, I've bounced around a lot of the camps here, and there are a lot of bad teams here. And, you know, when you come to the Giants and you're looking at what you're talking about, I mean, there are teams here like the Padres, the Angels, they don't even have five-man rotations. You know, and the Giants are worried about who's going to be their number five. It's a great problem at this point. Even the Dodgers, you know, they've got their first three guys, and their last two spots are up in the air, and that's hoping that their first three guys stay healthy this year because the entire rotation, except for Maeda last year, was hurt at some point or another. So, you know, I think the Giants are in good shape. You know, I like Melancon, and I think he'll do well. It's a perfect ballpark for him to pitch in. It's very spacious. It's hard to be too bad there, although Casilla and Romo found a way of doing it last year. You know, I guess left field, after going through the Pagans and Torres and Blanco is over with the Diamondbacks now. I mean, they've gone through some people, you know, in that position. Pat Burrell, I mean, you go down the list. So they really haven't had, really since Barry was there, they really haven't had Bonds. They really haven't had a regular left fielder. It's been a patchwork situation, you know, and it continues to be this year. You know, they'll get what they have out of Cain. They've got some kids in the minor leagues who are ready to move up. You know, really, with the top four they have, it's a good position to be in.
You know, speaking of left field, how do you look at it when you have two young guys that are vying for a spot like Parker and Williamson? Williamson has options, so he could get sent down. But, you know, the Giants have come out and said, Bobby Evans has said that he'd like one guy to kind of take that job so that they're not platooning. They're young guys. I mean, how do you look at that? And do you think the Giants did enough there in left field, you know, that they didn't pick up somebody and that they could rely on one of their young guys?
You know, look, they've got almost a $200 million payroll. For them, it's pretty high. And I think at some point you just say, you know, even the Yankees have done that. They've said, we have a $225 million payroll. If we can't win with that, then good luck. You know, and it's like we're not going out and spending any more money. So, I mean, I think they drew the line and just said we're going to go from within on some of our other things. But keep in mind, too, left field's not the only position. Third base, I'm not sold on Nunez as a third baseman. And that's another thing there. Since Panda left, they haven't filled that spot either. That's been a corral. And people forget Panda was a great postseason player for them. I'll bet sometimes during the regular season, you know, he was overweight and not in condition, and he wasn't great for the long haul. But when October came and they won those World Series in 12 and 14, you know, he was really there and a big part of it. And that's been, you know, a heart and soul and spiritual thing on the team that they haven't filled. So, I mean, you've got spots there. Obviously, you know, they've got some people in camp here with Aaron Hill and Jimmy Rollins, who they could use in backup slots. You know, I'm not sure that Rollins really fits it because he's a shortstop only and he's never played anywhere else. Hilly's great. I've known him really well. You know, he's bounced around a lot, but he's a good backup fill guy for them. He'll play third base. If Panic gets hurt again, he'll play second. A lot of it, you know, really, except for Crawford, you know, Panic, Posey, Pence, and Belt, you know, there are some spots in the lineup that are going to be rotating. And, you know, I don't care what Bobby wants and what Bobby's going to get are completely different things.
You know, Bobby Evans the other day was telling me in the dugout, I was saying, hey, you know, you got some interesting names. You already mentioned Jimmy Rollins and Hill. And then you got Michael Morse, and he said, yeah, you know, a few years ago, then it would have been something because those guys were more in their prime. I mean, right now, those guys are more trying to prove that they can still do it.
Right. I think this is the end of the line for Rollins, and it's pretty close on Hill, too. You know, and Hill's here, and they're both here on non-roster contracts, and they're both trying to make the team. And I think for Hill, it was just close to home, and he felt by at least working out here. If he didn't make this team, he could, you know, basically show himself to the rest of the league and somebody would pick him up because he's a good adjunct part. I mean, he really helped the Red Sox last year after they picked him up, you know, late in the season. Where was he, Milwaukee?
Yeah,
right. So, yeah, so they picked him up, and he was great as a fill-in there. So, you know, it's those kind of guys. I mean, there's still a lot of free agents out there, you know, haven't even signed. So when the smoke clears and teams in camp either they find out who's injured, they find out who can do what in camp, and then there's other people out there to go out and buy, and probably by the time they do, it's going to be so cheap that it's going to be worth buying.
Yeah, a guy like Angel Pagan, he's not signed anywhere yet.
Right, and he's playing in the WBC, so, you know, he's back playing with Puerto Rico. And Bochy likes him, and they've talked about bringing him back. So, yeah, he's a possibility.
More with Barry Bloom from MLB.com in just a moment. A little reminder, each week during the season, we'll be giving away a free T-shirt from thesportsvirus.com. All you have to do is ask a question for one of our guests, and if your question is chosen, you'll receive a free T-shirt from thesportsvirus.com. To send your questions in, email us at thesportsvirus@gmail.com or on Facebook, thesportsvirus.com page, and please like us while you're there. Have you ever heard of anything stranger than Michael Morse, the way he signed? I mean, he was at a wedding. He was attending Hunter Pence's wedding, and the next thing you knew, they were talking about a contract. I mean, maybe you have, because I know you've been around baseball a long time. You know, maybe you could tell us, are there any other comparable stories to that?
Well, off the top of my head, you know, no, but there are always these weird things. I will say this about Michael Morse, and I've said it over and over again, to you fans out there, National League fans who are hell bent on clinging to the DH, the Giants don't win the World Series in 2014 without Michael Morse as the DH in Kansas City, and I think last year the Cubs don't win the World Series without having Schwarber back in the lineup in Cleveland. They scored 5 runs without him in Wrigley Field, so. Morse was a great contributor there. It's too bad there's no DH in the National League. He'd be perfect here. But I just don't see a spot for him right now in the situation where you don't use a right-handed bat off the bench anymore. The way the National League has gone, when you're carrying 13 and 14-man pitching staffs, and that gives you your 8 starters, a backup catcher, and 2 guys. And those 2 guys have to be able to play everywhere. They have to be able to play multiple positions in the infield and the outfield. You know, the day of, like, left-handed bat specialist is over, and right-handed bat specialist is over. And if you can't play the field, you're not going to make the team. That's why I don't see guys like Morse and Rollins making this team.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because you remember when Barry Bonds was done. I mean, he could still hit. He could have been a designated hitter. He just didn't get signed. And speaking of Barry Bonds, I mean, Barry Bloom here, anybody who has followed him on MLB.com knows that, you know, back when he was in the home run chase in 2007, you know, Barry Bonds was just covered by everybody, but nobody covered him closer than you. So tell us a little bit about what you think his future is, because after being the hitting coach with the Marlins, people wondered, you know, maybe he'll have a position with the Giants. You know, what do you think will happen with Barry?
I think ultimately they'll figure it out and he's going to come back to the Giants. It's just a matter of, you know, what does he do? You know, where do they put him in the organization? You know, I think he wanted to try the hitting coach thing for a year. He really didn't have any other opportunity. And when Luria essentially sold him on it and Mattingly agreed to take him on, it was like it integrated himself back into baseball. And I was around him a lot last year. And it generally, you know, I think he did a pretty good job. I mean, he's more old school than these newer guys are. I think guys like Mattingly want to have, you know, their coaches around them all the time from early in the morning to late at night. You know, when a game is over, you know, they break down the game, they get ready for the next game. You know, and Barry, you know, sometimes came in late, but most of the time he was there in the batting cage very early with guys. But at the end of the game, pretty much he was gone on his bicycle out somewhere. And he wasn't, I don't think he was as interactive as they wanted him to be, even though the players loved him, And, you know, he worked with Stanton, you know, individually even before he got there in Los Angeles. And, you know, Barry said a lot of the guys called him all winter after he was even gone. And what he said there was that, you know, it took a year for them to really develop relationships with each other. And he said this year, if he came back, he would have been able to exert some discipline and do some things with them that he wasn't able to do last year during the feeling out process. Plus, he had another batting coach there who he didn't want to step on. And, you know, they developed. You know, Yelich had a great year there. Osuna, who was really a project for him, had a great year there for most of the year. There's a lot of stories. You know, I watched him interact with the media, with other people. One that I love telling is, you know, Bobby Cox, who told me this a couple of times. He basically, the Braves played the Marlins in Fort Dix, I think it was. They had a game there. They built a stadium. And lo and behold, Barry goes up to Bobby and says, you know, in more colorful terms, "Gee, I really wanted to apologize to you because when I was in baseball, I know I acted like a jerk." And Bobby said he was taken aback by it, had a great conversation with him. He said, "Barry, you know, as close as you are with him, I got to tell you, that was a side of Barry that I'd never seen before in my life. He's really changed." And, you know, I think that he has, you know, he's not a dumb guy. He's a very sharp guy. And if anybody is going to, you know, be introspective and think about what he did, it's Barry. He's had plenty of time to mull it over. And I think there's probably, if he had to do it all over again, there's probably 1,000 things he would have done differently. And if he had, it would have been a different situation. The whole thing would have turned out differently for him. But, you know, really, who knows? And there's nothing that can be done about it now. But I think what takes him aback is that it's not like he, you know, was a bad guy. I mean, he was grumpy. You know, he didn't take too much guff from anybody. And he handed it back with the best of them. And his game was, he intimidated people. And that was what he did on the field, too. And if he knew he couldn't intimidate you, and if he knew you could laugh at him, he was a great guy, you know, never had any problem with you. And then, and vice versa. You know, when you saw the look on his face, and he walked by you and growled or something, which he did at times with me, I just walked by him. Okay, it's like, leave him alone right now. And it basically, he said, you know, I know you. I was a tough guy to cover, but you know, the one thing I knew about you is that you were gonna write what you had to write, but you're never gonna do something intentionally to hurt me. You know, and he knew how complicated he was, and I think that, you know, once everybody in the organization gets past all that, because obviously there's some lingering feelings of mistrust within the organization, I think they'll see that, you know, Barry will be a great guy for the front of the organization, representing everybody. He does a lot of that stuff in private already. You know, they'll retire his number and do what's right and, you know, put another statue out there for him and move on. And I think it'll be great for everybody.
What about the lingering feelings amongst your writing peers when it comes to the Hall of Fame? Because, I mean, yeah, there was the Balco thing, and he's kind of tied right together with Roger Clemens. Do you think Bonds is going to get in? I mean, is he maybe mending some fences by changing the way you said that he has?
Well, I think what he's taken aback by is that he didn't do anything that was so bad that he can't be forgiven for it. You know, why are people still holding grudges against him after all these years? No matter how many times, and he's done it, I've written it, other people have written it, he's done mea culpas about this. You know, he's basically said, as far as my handling the media, if I could have done it differently, I would have done it differently. I mean, there's a great story with him and, you know, Tony Gwynn, who were, you know, they were really close friends. And, you know, Tony was looking at Barry one year, and he goes, "Barry, why do you act like this?" He goes, "I'll tell you what, we're going to the All-Star game. You just do what I do. Just follow everything I do." So he watched Barry, Tony in the locker room doing his thing, talking to people, you know, watched him, followed him. He goes, "Okay, I'll try to do it." So the season resumes, and, you know, he goes 0 for 15. and the teammates in the locker room are telling him, what the hell are you doing? I mean, it's like, you're not hitting. Go back to the way you were. So he did. And the next time he saw Tony, when the Padres came in, Tony said, Barry, what happened? And Barry said, Tony, I can't do what you do.
Which is to be great to everybody. I mean, Tony was beloved by his teammates and by the media. But, you know, it is funny when you talk to players about Bonds, and just recently I talked to Michael Morse about him, you always hear positive stuff. I mean, remember in 2014, Morse asked Bonds for some advice before a big at-bat in the postseason. Maybe it was before that home run. I don't remember what it was, but some little thing, you know, that just helped him out. I mean, he told him back, just, you know, take your singles every once in a while. I remember that being a key. So it just seems like players – they've always, you know, admired him and gotten along with him. And you know, that kind of gets lost in everything.
You know, there was a having been around Tony and Barry as long as I was, there was a group of people in the Padre clubhouse who didn't like Tony. You know, they thought on the field that, you know, he could hit the ball, pull the ball, and drive in more runs, especially when Bochy had batting third. And he was always flicking the ball to left field to get his hits, because primarily for him, he wanted 3,000 hits. That's what the day he started baseball, that was his goal. And he always felt that if he pulled the ball and tried to drive in runs, he was going to give up hits. I think he realized late in his career, after Ted Williams gave him the riot act, that it wasn't necessarily true. And when he saw Barry win batting titles with like 140 hits and 200 walks, then he really knew it wasn't true, because he said he had to reevaluate the whole way of hitting 400, you know, because Barry had done it so much differently. So, you know, there was as much behind the scenes tumultuous things with Tony, and Tony wasn't really as much of this person that we represented him as, but he treated us so well. And I'll tell you, I wrote a book with him, which is still sitting there and hasn't been published. I was part of the crew that created the image, you know, and I'm not saying anything about Tony. Tony was a great guy, but there was a dark side of him. With Barry, he was what he was. That's it. You know, there was no dark side, no light side to Barry. Barry was one of the more honest people that I've ever met in sports. You know, he's not the greatest guy in the world. He's not the worst guy in the world. You know, he's got a lot of problems which go back to his childhood, which he's never been able to get over. Really, Tony had no excuse. He was raised by a great mother, great father, great neighborhood, had great brothers, married his sweetheart from high school. I mean, Tony created his own problems. You know, Barry had a lot to overcome and is still trying to overcome it, and it'll all come out, you know, when we finally sit down and finish up the book that we've been working on for a while. But, I just think that in a lot of ways Barry is misunderstood, but in a lot of ways he knows it's his own fault.
I can't wait to read that book when you do finish that. You know, one thing that you made me think of when you were talking about Bonds and maybe his style as a hitting coach being old school, you know, today everybody's talking about exit velocity and launch angle and stuff like that. And I wonder, I mean, how does that fit in with anybody who's old school? And especially if you were a superstar player, I mean, how do you convey what you did as such a great hitter to some of these young guys? I mean, is it almost impossible to expect a guy like that to have the patience with players that don't hit the way he did?
You know, I think as a superstar, he's one of the few guys who could do that. I think Tony couldn't do it. That's why Tony was fine as a college coach, because Tony he couldn't put up with standing at a batting cage working with even kids and not having them listen to what he was saying and not seeing it translate onto the field. It took him a long time as a college coach to figure out that these are just kids. They're students. They have girlfriends. They have exams. They have a lot of things to do, which beyond what they have to do on the baseball field. And so he had to temper the way he acted, or else he was not going to last. You know, and with Barry, you know, we've talked about this too. Barry might be as smart a person when it comes to hitting as anybody I've ever talked to. And most of it with Barry is just reactions. And this is where, you know, the guys, it's like the old Woody Allen line in Annie Hall. You know, those that can't do teach, and those that can't teach, teach Jim. You know, those that can't do have analytics. Those that can do know that it's mostly reaction. And there's two things that astounded me about Barry which are really simple. A, he said he knew that where the ball, whether it was a ball or a strike, before it even got out of the pitcher's hand. That's number one. Number two, you know, he walked 2,550 times. You know, about 1,000 of them were intentional. That's 5.5 years of at-bats. If you took away even 1,000 of them, he would have hit 800, 900 home runs. And basically, and he said that, he knew that, he knew he wasn't going to get pitched to, and he said he saw maybe 3 hittable pitches a game, and he still got his home runs. So, and he said, how do you stand there and tell a player, you know, from my perspective, this is what I'm going to tell you to do. I don't know how to do it because I just do it. So to break it down and tell you this is what you have to do, I can't tell you to do what I can do because there's not too many people in the world who could do what I can do. You know, so basically he understands that you have to take apart that guy's game individually and make him the best player he can for what he has and what his ability it is to do. And if you do that, and that's what I was talking about with the guys in Miami, you know, basically, after a year, he could deconstruct those guys, and he had learned enough and earned enough of their, you know, faith and friendship that this year he probably would have been able to sit down and deconstruct them and teach them something, you know. But it took a year for all that to develop. You know, when you look at it, you go, you know, I'm Christian Yelich. I grew up in L.A. You know, this is Barry Bonds. I mean, the first thing you think is, I can't believe my batting coach is Barry Bonds, and I'm scared as hell, you know, and how do I even relate with him? And, you know, I've heard all this stuff about him that everybody else has heard about him, and his image is so bad. How do you work with the guy? And then you realize that he's just a human being like everybody else. And, you know, part of it is when Barry played, he liked to be angry. You know, he used his anger, he fueled his anger, fueled him playing. He doesn't have to do that anymore. He's not playing. So essentially, when you peel it away, you know, he can be, you know, a decent guy. And that's the people who are getting to know him now.
By the way, to finish up, since you mentioned the intentional walks in Major League Baseball now, for a manager to intentionally walk somebody, just, you know, point out there and they just send the runner over to first base. The batter becomes a runner and no pitches, which – I don't know that it really saves that much time, and it kind of takes away, you know, is there going to be a wild pitch here, you know, on one of those 4 freebies? So how do you view the new rule?
I view it much like no-touch icing in hockey. You know, I don't like either of them, but I really don't care either way. I mean, I'm more, you know, in favor of them just getting rid of the intentional walk completely. You know, I hated it. Especially when Barry was playing, and I used to argue with managers about it all the time. When Mike Socia walked Barry 7 times in the 2002 World Series, you know, a good number of them with runners on first base, it was like, you know, really, okay, you want to win the game, I understand that, but baseball has to manage it better because you're taking the bat out of a great player's hands.
What about when Showalter walked him with the bases loaded,
yeah,
right?
Same thing. You know, So I my feeling was just get rid of it altogether. I mean, essentially, as a tactic, it's going away anyway. In the American League, nobody intentionally walks anybody. And in the National League, the only time you're going to get it is if the pitcher's up next and you have a number 8 hitter. And I think even guys think twice now because if you can get the pitcher out, you don't want to turn around the batting order too early by getting the number 1 hitter up. And then you start the batting order over, so the next inning. So I think it's a dead strategy. You know, Bill James basically the one thing that, you know, I totally agree with Bill James. I mean, there's 3 numbers in baseball that are important. It's runs, outs, and how many runs you can score in those amount of outs. That's it. So why would you give up? Why would you give up a base, or why would you give up an out by sacrificing a runner, you know, with a bunt or walking somebody intentionally. It makes absolutely no sense. Those are like, you have 27 outs in a game, and you have to score enough runs to win the game. Don't give up outs or bases at a time when you're trying, especially as analytical as the game has gotten with shifts and everything. Man, don't do that. So, I mean, to me, hopefully this is a step to like, hey, it's stupid. Let's get rid of it anyway.
Maybe you can write a book, Abolish the Intentional Walk by Barry Bloom. I think that would be a good read.
Well, I have my, but that's one of my peeves. My other suggestion is, which nobody likes, is sudden death baseball. The guy, if you go to the bottom of the ninth inning, top of the 10th, somebody hits a home run in the top of the 10th, the game's over. That's it.
Kind of like the NFL. I mean, yeah, touchdown, game over.
Right. And so... You really will save a lot of time, because how many games have you seen where, the team scores two times in the top of the 10th and then it's matched in the bottom of the 10th and you're sitting there going, oh, God, do we really need this?
That's too much of an advantage for the visiting team, though.
Well, right now it's an advantage for the home team, because the home team bats last and they are sudden death.
Right.
So big deal. So you make it either or. Whoever knocks it out, game's over, and then you really save some time. Plus, I do think that, one of my favorite things is the 3-on-3 overtime in hockey. It's really exciting. I watch it. I stand up for the overtime period. And especially even in the regulation overtime in the cup playoffs, I've always loved that. I mean, you're just sitting there on the edge of your seat waiting for the game to end. Every second, it's as draining to watch almost as it is to play. And I think you give baseball that kind of shot, too, where every pitch after, the top of the ninth inning, the game's riding on every pitch, and every pitch becomes significant and exciting, and that's the way the game ends.
We'll see. Lots of things are changing. Barry, thanks so much for the time. Great to see you here in Scottsdale, and hope to catch up again during the season.
Yeah, anytime, Joe. Always a treat with you.
That's Barry Bloom from MLB.com. I want to thank him and Giants left-hander Ty Block for joining us today. Coming up on Wednesday, we'll hear from Brandon Crawford, who won another Gold Glove last year, and Christian Arroyo, who has been very impressive in spring training and looking to nail down a spot at some point this season on the Giants roster. For now, I'm Joe Castellano. Thanks for listening to Inside China Basin on the SportsVirus.com and now on CanBR.com.